This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select sort of at random, except for this episode, but more about that later. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 85th episode of the Quarter Bin, we're looking at Mars, number 1, from First Comics, cover dated all the way back in January, 1984. But first, a little feedback. Grant Richter from the Vision-themed blog Unearthly Visions found the show as a result of those Vision and Scarlet Witch episodes from a month or two back. Well, after those, he did the deep dive into past episodes and had this to say about episode 40, in which Scott Gardner and I covered ROM number 1. As promised, after your Vision and Scarlet Witch episodes, I'm working on playing catch-up. The fact that it was Parker Brothers who introduced the idea of the dire wraiths was brilliant marketing. They didn't need to create a supporting cast of villain figures because a kid could pretend that literally any other toy he owned was an evil, shape-changing space wizard. No, that's not my Mego Aquaman. That's a dire wraith. Okay, Grant, that is an awesome point. I wonder if that was the intent. I can't say that it was, but either way, it turns out, as you said, to be a pretty genius marketing strategy. And then, feedback on the Amalgam books from a few episodes back. Bradley Null wrote in, "Ah, yes, the mid-range comics of Amalgam. I don't think there are two more 90s-ish comics." He did say that, like me, he loved the Captain Marvel, Captain Marvel mix, and added that, "This one does have some of my favorite mixes. Martian / Skrull and the Night Creeper are my favorites." I was a big fan of the Night Creeper as well. The name Xavier was also used as a secret ID of Jean in the Silver Age. Now, I did not know that little tidbit about Jean occasionally taking the name Xavier at some points in his past. Nice touch. Thanks for that info, Bradley. And then some feedback on Halloween Times, our pair of Phantom Stranger episodes. A lot of people were displeased about the lack of Rob Kelly in the second of those episodes. I got a lot of tweets about that. Actually, they were all tweets for shows hosted by Rob Kelly, so it's possible he was the only person complaining about it now that I think about it. The Sutherlands, from Trekker Talk, Xenozoic Xenophiles, and Warlord Worlds, wrote in about those episodes. "We thoroughly enjoyed your two-episode coverage of the Phantom Stranger on the Quarter Bin. Great for Halloween. It was very nice to hear Rob on the show. And it was great to hear that story again of him contributing to help replace Len Wein's comic collection. Such an uplifting story. Great job, Rob." They also said that that first Phantom Stranger episode made for a quasi two-parter with Mark Sweeney, former guest on the show. For his Halloween episode of I'm the Gun, he covered a Dr. 13 story, which we'll try not to mention to Rob Kelly, okay? He's a little touchy about Dr. 13. The Sutherlands then talked about their recent episode with Diablo Frank about Wonder Woman and said that they were looking forward to the Wonder Woman content that we've got coming soon over on this feed. Thanks for another great episode. Well, thank you, Darren and Ruth. And some feedback from halfway around the world. It's Paul Hicks of the Waiting for Doom podcast. It's Paul Hicks of the Waiting for Doom podcast. "Professor Allen, I greatly enjoyed your Quarter Bin coverage of the first issue of the Phantom Stranger miniseries. I'm sure I would have bought this one if I'd ever seen it. But since I don't have it, I guess I never did. I was unaware that Val Vostok from Kupperberg's Doom Patrol was a featured character. having a cast of minor supporting characters that he could move from DC title to DC title was something that Paul Kupperberg seemed to enjoy doing across books like Vigilante, Checkmate, Power Girl, Doom Patrol. John Ostrander did similar things with the priest character, Father Kramer, moving him from Suicide Squad to Spectre to Martian Manhunter. Do we know of other comic writers who did this much? Cheers, Paul. Well, I'll throw that open to Quarterbin listeners. Can you think of examples of writers who've reused some of their minor characters across a variety of titles? I do love the concept. I think it gives books a real lived-in sort of feel. And I assume now that you know, Paul, that Val Vostok is a major character. Well, a featured... she appears in these Phantom Stranger issues that an upcoming episode of Waiting for Doom will feature the conclusion of this miniseries. Laurel, or Mountain Flower on Twitter, wrote in to ask if I was going to do another Veterans Day episode, like I did last year. Loved hearing three vets review Blackhawk 122 with you. This episode will be out around Veterans Day, and the answer to that is actually no. But I do have some more war comics from the quarter bins, so maybe next year. You know, Laurel, now that you mention it, I really enjoyed doing that last year, so yeah, maybe next year. Also, on Twitter, I was Joe Crawford, Pat from the Longbox Crusade and the Sutherlands, promoted either one or both of the Phantom Stranger episodes on that platform. Thank you, guys. And Clinton Robison from the Coffee and Comics blog wrote in, Professor Allen, another great show. Beginning to think you aren't going to have a bad one. Well, thank you, Clinton, and I'm beginning to think that someone might have spiked your morning coffee, but I appreciate the kind words. In regards to your comment about the Phantom Stranger not really having a story arc, not really changing over time, I figured that would be obvious. I mean, he's the Phantom Stranger, not the Phantom Changer. Yeah, Clinton, somebody has definitely spiked your coffee, if you thought that was funny. Okay, enough of this foolishness. We have a comic book to talk about. And that comic book is Mars Number 1, which had a cover price of $1, meaning I acquired this book at a 75% markdown. Well, sort of, but not really, but kind of, in a manner of speaking. I'll talk about that later in the episode, okay? The cover is by the creators of Mars, Mark Wheatley and Mark Hempel. Emily and I have talked more than once about the various comic book covers that are homages to the Pietà. Crisis on Infinite Earth 7 might be the most iconic of these, although there are many, many examples. Aquaman 37 from the 1960s is another famous one. And Mars, Number 1, is another. But it does have its own spin, a futuristic take on this important artistic motif. We have, walking toward us, an egg-shaped body on long, spindly robot legs. The face of a woman appears on the egg, along with a serial number, indicating it's a robot of some kind. In its metallic arms, this robotic being is carrying a woman. All of this is happening on an alien landscape of pinks and purples. It's an evocative, effective pose. Along with the weird font for the title of the comic, Mars, it definitely gives the impression of being something very different. In addition to the 1982 artist signatures that are a part of the cover, my copy also features 2016 signatures from the two creators. But again, I'll tell that story later in the episode. The story, titled Rebirth, was written, drawn, inked, colored, and lettered by the aforementioned Mark Wheatley and Mark Hempel. This is an independent book of the most independent variety. The only other name in the credits is editor Mike Gold. We start at a press conference given by a research tech company. Dr. Nathan Trace, discusses an operation that implanted an organic computer chip into a young man's brain. The doctor invented the implant, but the surgery was not a success. He and his child prodigy daughter, Morgana, who assisted in the surgery, are answering questions. The boy's father storms the stage at the press conference, activating a laser lawnmower weapon. The man's wife grabs his arm, throwing off his aim. Morgana is hit, and her spine is severed. In her delirium, she believes she hears from her dying father. He tells her that memory is self. It's the whole mind, it's order. And he promises that she will find him again if she looks for order. But she knows the truth. She knows that now she is a paraplegic. I can't run, Dad. I can't walk. I'll never find you. A month after the incident, bound to her wheelchair, Morgana ponders this interaction with her father. She throws herself into his research, pushing it further. She receives advanced degrees, making her, at age 13, one of the youngest PhDs in the nation. Her father's work was in memory and in human-computer interface. Morgana creates a process that not only strengthens her own damaged nerves by electronically bypassing the damage to give herself some level of mobility, but her discoveries also allow for direct transfer of knowledge. Anyone could gain the knowledge, if not the skill, of a surgeon, engineer, pilot, instantly. But use of her discoveries are severely restricted by the government, pending what they call corroborative research. While protests roil on Earth, Morgana decides to join a research project on the moon. "Gravity is my enemy," she tells a friend. "But up there, I'll be able to start walking again." She settles in with a small crew on the moon, using her knowledge to place her mind inside a powerhouse robot built by one of her crewmates, Cal Drifkin. Later, she's invited to join the 11th mission to the planet Mars. The crew includes a captain, a medical tech, a reverend, and a representative of the common man. Mars has been seeded with life. Canals have begun to develop in the dry desert lands. Flowering plants have been planted, which have begun to produce minimal levels of oxygen. A lot of this work has been made possible by those powerful metallic robots that have been developed and the brain transference process that Morgana has developed. The Red Planet is still a long ways away from being able to sustain human life unaided, but that process has begun. In transit to Mars, the crew loses contact with both the moon and Earth. "The problem is at their end," the captain says. "I think we should expect the worst." That worst may be major catastrophes, perhaps an uprising. They just don't know. But it adds up to one thing, people. Earth is off the air. The Mars crew ends up putting themselves in suspended animation in the space station above Mars. "If Earth doesn't claim us," Morgana reasons, "then we'll just sleep for 10,000 years. That should give Mars a chance to bloom." And she goes into suspended animation herself, and she wonders what they'll find when they wake up. When Morgana wakes up, she learns from the onboard computer that 10,001 standard Mars years have passed, but there's nobody left at the space station. Everyone else woke up before Morgana and left, but the computer's memory of that time has been wiped, and there's nothing left in storage, no food. She's wondering what's happened and why they've left her there. She goes to the hydroponics lab, but finds that the equipment there has been stripped. She sees that two of the large robots are still available, and she takes control of one to prepare a shuttle for departure to the Red Planet. She flies the shuttle towards Mars, which has developed some colorful vegetation and some insect life in the intervening centuries, millennia. But the gyros on the machine are mucked up, and the landing is more of a controlled crash, barely controlled crash, than anything else. The human Morgana is injured, unconscious, perhaps worse. The robot under her control takes the damaged body of her creator into her metallic arms and walks away from the crash site towards a colorfully forested part of the planet. And back at the crash site, a brown furry creature, vaguely human-sized and vaguely human-shaped, crawls over the damaged ship and looks in the direction that Morgana and her robot were heading.
Adolescents this generation have no respect and are a far cry from my sweet Jane Eyre and her friend Helen Burns. Why, just this afternoon I was
Stella.
Walking across, and you know what? Men too. Well,
Stella.
Serious men like the tragic Mr. Rochester and teachers, pa! They're all like the villainous Mr. Brocklehurst.
Hey, Stella!
Yes, Thomas?
As much as I enjoy indulging your insanity, we have a promo to record.
Oh dear, and what might that be?
That is you and I telling everyone that we have a brand new podcast out there. It's called Required Reading with Tom and Stella. Once a month, we will take a look at a single work of literature, discuss it, analyze it, and determine if it's worth its place in the canon.
Oh dear, that sounds delightful.
Oh, I'm sure it will be. And you can find us on the Two True Freaks Network, which is at twotruefreaks.com.
Oh yes, Required Reading with Tom and... Why is it Tom and Stella? Why can't it be Stella and Tom?
It rolls off the tongue better?
Okay.
Well, that was easy. So, Required Reading with Tom and Stella at twotruefreaks.com. Thanks for contributing to the promo there. You did a great job.
Oh, you are so welcome.
And we're back. I have a history with this title, with this issue in particular. The exact copy I'm holding, I mean. A couple of stories, actually. First, let me talk about how I acquired my copy of Mars Number One. And for that, we have to get in the Wayback Machine and dial in fall 1983. It was my freshman year of college, and I didn't have a car on campus. But I did have a comic book store that Google Maps places as a 1.7-mile walk from my freshman dorm in the same shopping center as the nearest grocery store. So every now and then, when I needed groceries, and when the weather was nice, and when I didn't have all that much homework to do, I would head up to Dave's Comics. And more often than not, I'd pick up some indie books or whatever other weird stuff I was reading. The month that Mars Number One came out, it's very likely that I also picked up copies of John Sable Freelance and Thriller. Yes, I was that one guy that bought Thriller. But that's an episode, or more, for another day. Eventually, from Dave's Comics, I picked up books like Axel Pressbutton, The Maze Agency, and Eternity Smith. Anyway, I picked up Mars Number One probably on my first or second trip to the store. It ended up being the only issue of that title that I did buy. The series ran 12 issues total, but these smaller press books had limited distribution, or for whatever reason, I just never saw it again. Now, you may be thinking, Professor Allen, if you bought this book off the shelves more than 30 years ago, how does it count as a quarter bin book? I'll be honest, that's a great question. I think I have a great answer, though. When I started this podcast, Mars Number One was in my general comic book collection, but it was not in the quarter bin database, because I did in fact pay 4 quarters for it, not just one. But let me address every single listener who is concerned about me possibly violating the rules of this podcast. In other words, let me address Shag. The way I do it is if there's a book that I already have in my collection, and I see that exact book in a quarter bin, then that book moves into the quarter bin database. So even though, in a technical sense, I did not purchase this copy of Mars Number 1 for a quarter, I did see a copy of Mars Number 1 on sale recently for a quarter. The spirit of the podcast is talking about books that can be found in quarter bins. And this book qualifies. And that's good enough for me. Second story. This one I actually did sort of break the rules on. And that is, how did this book get assigned to episode 85? Hint, it wasn't random. I recently talked with Tom Panarese over at Pop Culture Affidavit about the visit that Emily and I took this year to Baltimore Comic Con over Labor Day weekend. Before the event, I went through the con's guest list and cross-referenced that list with my collection and discovered that these two creators, Mark Hempel and Mark Wheatley, were going to be there. They're part of a larger artist group now based out of Baltimore, Insight Studios, and that studio had a pretty big table. And when I dropped Mars Number 1 on that table for the two Marks to sign, both of them chuckled. And one of the Marks, I can't really remember which one, specifically said, "I really like that book." And I said, "I really liked it too." So, getting two fresh signatures on a book I'd recently seen in a quarter bin, I decided right then that this book would fill the first empty slot in the quarter bin schedule. And here we are. So to summarize, it's a comic that I didn't pay a quarter for in a strict technical sense, and I didn't actually pick it at random for this episode. Now, if you have any issues with that, just let me know, and you can contact my lawyers. They're a part of the Latverian Better Business Bureau, and they have a lot of experience dealing with, how do they put it, customer complaints. But I've got an idea for now. Let's actually talk about what's in this comic. And there was a ton going on in this issue. It's that common joke these days that an issue like this would be a four-issue miniseries. And there's something to that, but I think what's going on here might actually be a little different than that. This was very early in these guys' careers, and it obviously took them a while to get the book published. The cover is signed by the guys, and they dated it 1982, and the book came out late in 83 with a January 84 cover date. So basically a full year passed between the cover being created and the issue being published. Now there is certainly a lag time in comic book publishing, but that seems longer than average. And I wonder if it's just because they were such new creators. Let me draw a parallel. Back at my old church, when we lived in Virginia, one of the elders was given a chance to preach. And even though this guy had the title of elder, he wasn't all that old. Only a few years older than me, and this is about a quarter century ago. Anyway, this guy preached. And he preached. And he preached. Probably a good 30 minutes longer than the standard sermon at that church. We were friends, and I kind of poked fun at him for rambling so long in his sermon. And he had a pretty serious response, actually. He said he didn't know if he'd ever have the chance to preach a sermon again. And he decided to throw in everything he'd ever wanted to say in a sermon. I think maybe Mars Number 1 was a similar situation for the Marks. This is their first chance to publish steady work, to publish their own work. And I think they threw all of their ideas into this first issue. On the chance that they wouldn't have a chance to write a second issue? Pulp sci-fi adventure? Space exploration? Terraforming Mars? Family drama? A physically challenged hero? A physically challenged heroine? Being stranded on Mars? 10,000 years of suspended animation? Robots? Mind transference? Mind transference into robots? Why pick and choose? Let's do it all! And I give them credit for one thing. They certainly did it all. There are so many ideas crammed into these pages. Many of them really good ideas. I love that. And they are jammed in here, though. And that didn't give the Marks a chance to more clearly explain what was going on in the issue. That synopsis that I did in the first half of the episode, I'm guessing I may have gotten 80% of the details right. As things move quickly, and cause and effect isn't always clear. The amount of time that passes isn't always clear. A few text boxes here and there may have helped, a little narration maybe, something. I took a look at Comic Book DB, and from issues 2 through 8, Peter Gillis is listed as a co-writer, and then one of our favorites, John Ostrander, co-wrote issues 10 through 12. Same thing with the art. Tom Sutton is added to the team for the 6 issues following this. Then Don Lomax assists on one, and Doug Rice joins for the final 3 issues. Additional colorists and letterists were also added to the team, obviously. I mean, there's no way that these two guys could do all of the work on a comic and keep it monthly. Again, literally, they did all of the work, including the coloring and the lettering, to go along with, obviously, the scripting, penciling, inking, oh, and the cover. And they did actually keep it monthly for the first 9 issues, the last 3 coming out every other month. And obviously, these other guys were brought in to keep the schedule on track, as well as, I imagine, rein in these two guys a little bit, fill out the team with some people with maybe a little more experience in the comic book world than the Marks had at this point in their career. I've never read the rest of the issues, although a collection just came out a few years ago. So I don't know if the manic pace of issue 1 continues on, or if, in fact, the series does maybe improve upon some of those concerns I mentioned earlier, that I do just put down to the youth of the creators. I do hope that the energy of issue 1 survives. I hope that that's not lost. Like I said, a ton of ideas. My favorites included a few that I wish had been developed, such as this access to this direct download technology. There were a few panels of uprising, of potential riot, and then this mysterious aspect of losing contact with Earth. Someone on the Mars team does float the idea that the riots may be a part of that, but then we jump 100 centuries ahead before that's developed. And of course, I'm a sucker for the father-daughter relationship, anytime I see a good one of those. Again, if this issue were split into 3 issues, maybe a few more pages of backstory of that relationship would have been nice. Of course, I don't know whether we get flashbacks to the father later in the series. I hope so, because I would like to see more of that. That was just one of the things that got sped by to get to all of the places they wanted to get to in this first issue. Because every time I think about something I'd want to see more of here in issue 1, the very legitimate question comes up. Where would you have put it? There was no room. So that's a very fair point. But then again, you have ideas like this everyman representative on the team. There's actually a reference somewhere to the ordinary man elections or something. And again, that phrase is just dropped into the story in a couple of places. And I'm sure the Marks had a developed backstory for that concept, an explanation, at least in their own minds, for what they were getting at with that concept. It's just not delivered, at least here in the first issue. What I do like, though, is the unanswered questions. That's one of the things that a first issue has to do. It has to give us some reasons to want to read the later issues. And this one certainly does that. Why was she not awakened when the rest of the crew was? Is the rest of the crew, in fact, on Mars? What went on back on Earth all those years ago, centuries ago, millennia ago? Will she see her father again in some way? And, of course, this creature from the last page. Is that friend or foe? The verdict on Mars number 1. To be fair, I bought this one and never bought any others, so again, in a strict technical sense, I guess this issue didn't work on me back then. Some of the other series I mentioned earlier that I picked up at the time, I did continue with. But I'm putting some of the blame on that on First Comics, their distribution, and my lack of regular attendance at Dave's Comics. Because although I've never picked up the rest of this series, I've also never seen it in the wild. It's not like there are a million copies of the Mars series floating around. It's not like I've passed up opportunities to read the issues. I've just literally never seen them. And a lot of those comics back in the day, I have to admit, did not stay in my collection. But Mars number 1 always has. It made it past every purge, every cut. 32 years later, I still had this issue. It was obviously something about it back then that did work on me, though I remembered almost none of the plot details of the story. There must have been something about this issue that I liked. Some pleasant feeling, some nostalgia, something persisted that kept this book in my collection for all of those years. Is this a great comic book? No, it's not that. Is it a good comic book? I think so. Is it an interesting comic book? Yes. Definitely interesting, definitely energetic. Young creators at the start of their careers just throwing everything they have into their first big project. It's a definite quarter bin deal. And maybe somewhere deep down I don't even mind having actually paid a dollar for it all those years ago. Except that a dollar in 1983 is worth almost $2.50 now, so... Well, I don't know, all those numbers are confusing to me. I just need to wrap up my coverage of Mars Number 1 right now. That wraps up my coverage of Mars Number 1, bringing episode 85 of the Quarterbin Podcast to a close. In episode 86, we're having a party. A birthday party. Maybe an anniversary party, depending on how you look at it. Either way, Wonder Woman made her debut 75 years ago, and we're going to celebrate by covering DC Retroactive Wonder Woman 1970s from DC Comics, cover dated September 2011. If you have any questions or comments about this issue, the episode, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin. The Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Shortbox Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening. Professor!